This is the ARC Energy Ideas Podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome again. It's Peter Terzakian for the ARC Energy Ideas Podcast. It's June 14th, and I am with
Jackie Forrest, and I want to welcome our guest, Patrick Bryden, an analyst with Scotia Capital who covers the equity markets and in addition has done a lot of work on ESG.
Welcome, Pat. I've known you for so long. It's just a delight to have you here. How long have I known you? I think it's like 25 years or something.
It's getting on for sure.
It's getting on, and I'm really delighted. Pat, I mean, as an equity analyst, you follow the oil and gas industry. You have followed the capital markets pretty much for all those 25 years, and I just have a tremendous amount of respect for your work. So it's really an honor for us to have you here and talk about some of the great work that you are doing on ESG. Jackie, what is ESG for our listeners?
So it's environmental, that's the E. S is social, includes things like safety, and then G is governance. And we've talked about ESG in the past on the podcast,
a lot,
so hopefully it's totally not new to people, but it is a growing trend in terms of differentiating oil and gas companies. The ones that have a better focus on environment, social, and governance are, I think, getting rewarded. We're here going to hear Pat's view on that.
Yeah, well, Pat, you've written an incredible report. It's almost a book. I think it's 100 and some pages of very detailed, you know, what is ESG, each one of those environment, social, and governance thing in great detail. But we're posting this online, aren't we, Jackie?
Yeah, we're going to post a link to the report, and I definitely recommend it.
Yeah,
that's part of why
yeah.
we wanted to have you on, Pat, is it's just great reading. I've been very interested in this area for some time now, and I've never seen anything that gives such a great comprehensive background on the rise of ESG, all the academic research to support, you know, why it matters. And there's a growing body of evidence out there, but not all in one place. And so many factors, everything indigenous to millennials to
the Stone Age.
It
goes all the way back to the Stone Age and talks about the periodic table and the elements and, you know, because so much of environment is about synthetic chemicals now that are coming into our environment. And so, Pat, you know, you take it all the way back to the beginning about how humanity has created civilization and the elements and so on. And now where we are today, in terms of things like emissions and toxic waste, et cetera, et cetera, but that also what companies are doing about it. And this is what this is really all about. It's not just about E, as we said, it's about safety and governance and social issues too. And that this is becoming much more important in terms of how investors view companies, especially in the public markets, who they will put their money in. And so if there is an ESG bias, you are more likely to get investment than if there isn't.
Firstly, I do want to just say that it's a real honor to be here, and I have truly valued your partnership with us over the years, and I've had a path that has required lots of help over the years, so I really do sincerely appreciate the opportunity to be here, and Scotiabank does as well. I also want to say that on this journey, it's not just me. There's been a whole bunch of people I've been joined with. So a couple of my colleagues I want to mention, Justin Strong and Klazina Vandenberg, have been a big part of this effort. And my head of research, John Henderson, as well as a number of other partners up on to the upper echelons of the firm have indulged this. And that's been very
Yeah, usually
very
these kind
gratifying.
Of reports are actually private for investors only, but it is going to be made public on our website. So it's awesome.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Pat, before we get into the ESG, can you just talk in general, what's the sentiment like for oil and gas equities right now?
Yeah, it's certainly been challenging to state the obvious, and I don't mean to come on the show and become a master of the obvious, but it has been very, very trying circumstances. I am old enough to have been in the sector for long enough to have seen some pretty severe downturns and some pretty buoyant and heady upturns. But I'm also young enough to be taught new lessons and learn from those lessons. So there's certainly a lot of reasons we could pick our way through here to understand why we're going through what we're going through. I think a big part of that story is about the economics, and we can never lose sight of the fundamentals in our day job. So energy markets are complex. They're incredibly interesting to try to figure out. And I think if I can borrow an adage from you, Peter, in the past, it's almost like the more you go on, the more you realize the less you know and how much there is to know. So from my perspective, there's a division between kind of Canada, the United States, and the rest of the world. some of the issues that we're all dealing with are common between all those different segments, and some are obviously specific to Canada.
Yeah, so economics, in other words, you're basically saying the price of the commodities, the price of oil, the low price of gas, the differentials, price of all the stuff we've talked about on this show before. So there's reticence to invest in Canadian oil and gas companies because of uncertainty about the economics. But there's also, of course, all the political and policy regulatory uncertainty overlays as well. That's another thing, right? And you know, to what extent is that weighing on the markets?
I think that's spot on. I would come back to the fundamental question of the economics and where does Canada and all its various hydrocarbon plays, if you like, reside on the cost curve in North America and globally. So that is the fundamental question about the economic side. And then there are these incremental overlays that do get into egress and the inherent kind of political nature.
The market access issues, no pipelines,
for sure.
In other words, and so on. So, you know, again, to summarize, like we've got the whole technological revolution, the ability to produce more faster than we can take it away. So that's weighing on the markets. It's weighing on price, which weighs on the markets. Then we have the whole policy regulatory issue. But what you're saying in this report is that now companies which pay attention to this environmental social governance, well, actually, I like to think of it in the converse. If you don't pay attention to it, you're definitely going to be relegated to the bargain basement discount table.
Yeah. I think that's right. I think we're looking for companies that represent what I would describe as kind of new economy ideas as opposed to old economy ideas.
Yeah. I wanted to mention in your report, one thing that was quite interesting to me is you had some really good academic research that showed that in companies that do care about ESG, material ESG risks, do better than those that don't. Because I think there's a perception out there, this is a bit of greenwashing, window dressing really doesn't affect the profitability of a company. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. And we've come to know some of the folks behind these studies as well, which has been a really interesting process. So one of the first ones we show up front in the book is a very well-known study by Robert Eccles, Ionis Ayanu, and then George Seraphim. So they're a group that initially came out of Harvard, and they wrote a study called The Impact of Corporate Sustainability on Organizational Processes and Performance. So sounds kind of like a dry academic name, but it's actually an incredible study because what they did was they looked at companies that, and I'm summarizing here, but they looked at companies that were effectively exhibiting high sustainability characteristics, and they horse raced those back in time over an 18-year period against companies that had low sustainability characteristics. And What I want your listeners to really understand is this is not an ivory tower exercise. They're looking back at kind of practical, real-world examples of what actually happened to companies.
Not just oil and gas.
Correct. Broad economy. Yeah. That's right. And the performance multiplier over that time frame, whether you look at shareholder return or you look at return on assets or return on equity, if you take it on a value-weighted basis of the portfolio you started in each bucket to start and where you ended, the companies with high sustainability characteristics outperformed by about a 1.6 times multiplier. It's a very, very significant outperformance.
So you're saying that you would make 60% more on your money than if you had put it in just an
underperformer.
The raw tonnage would say that.
Yeah.
And so that over time is obviously a very meaningful level of outperformance. And so that's one that I found to be very persuasive. And when I tried to think about that in a real-world context, it really does make sense to me. And the way I would simplify it for myself and you and any of your listeners is to just think about, okay, let's look at a company, and if they're run in a way where they're trying to do things well and do the right thing, and we can talk later about what the right thing is, but I would say good stewardship, that company's probably going to do better than others.
But some of these metrics, and you know, there's just a whole raft of metrics that you show in your report, which is just amazing. But under the S and the G, like G, governance would include things like diversity on boards, gender diversity,
right,
for example. And under the S, there's indigenous relationships and so on.
Yep.
These are difficult things to quantify. Yet those you also show, and there are academic studies that add to the value of a company.
Yeah, for sure. I would say that if and I wasn't doing this 10 or 15 years ago, but I imagine if I tried to, there would have not been much, if any, data on those realms of S and G. So today, we actually do have a remarkable amount of data. And so I would argue that in Canada, the disclosure is such that we're probably playing with about a, like if you look at the TSX 60, so that would represent, you know, probably 70 plus percent of the market value of Canada's market.
So 60 of the top companies in the Toronto Stock Exchange.
Yeah, and so that's S&P TSX index, the 60. Those companies with their disclosure represent about a two-thirds deck of cards in terms of what we can look at now. Mm-hmm. So we're not 100% in our ability to evaluate everything. And the environmental and the social disclosures are largely voluntary. The governance disclosures that we largely see are typically more mandatory from a regulatory perspective. But certainly, if you bring it back to the academic theory and research, and again, theory and research, don't be scared by that because it's looking at practical, real-world examples. One of the ones that was the most persuasive to me was a study by McKinsey. And my wife has been on me to get walking more, so I've been walking back and forth to work, and I have been listening to a bunch of podcasts to try to get up the curve on all these matters.
Including ours.
That's right. Avid listener. But one of the most powerful things I listened to was a study out of McKinsey. And to be honest, I came into this whole thing thinking the S, quote unquote, might be the, for lack of a better expression, the most flaky thing to investigate. And I actually think it could be the most potent. So the McKinsey work is a whole series of studies that they've now done on diversity. But it was led initially by a lady named Vivian Hunt out of London. And when I listened to this, I almost, like, I try to leave my work at home, at work and get home and enjoy time with family. Mm-hmm. But I had to actually talk to my family about this because what it did is it looked at gender diversity and then ethnic and culture diversity across businesses of all geographies, all countries, all different industries.
That's sort of in the workforce at large, not just the board of directors.
Correct. Yeah. And it looked at, it's actually evolved to look right from the companies up to the top of the mm-hmm. board. And what it showed was that if you looked at top quartile diversity companies versus bottom quartile diversity companies, the most recent version of this report indicates that on a gender basis, if you have more mix, more diversity, you're 21% more likely to outperform the industry average margin than a bottom quartile company.
There was more profitability.
Yeah, and if you take that to an ethnic cultural lens, it's 33% more likely that you'll outperform that industry average margin, again, than a bottom quartile if you're a top quartile business. So that kind of fit in with this whole kind of chemistry theme and mixtures theme that we were percolating report. Through our report. And I believe it. I sincerely believe it.
Well, it's common sense that if you have diversity of culture, gender, et cetera, then you have diversity of thought. Mm-hmm. And so much of business is about challenging status quo, challenging issues from different lenses, different perspectives. Mm-hmm. So to me, that's just common sense.
That's exactly right. You want to get rid of groupthink and you want people to challenge the status quo.
Yeah.
Hey, I want to talk about a term that's in your paper called unconscious bias. It's a term that I didn't hear much in the past, but in the last 6 months, I hear it all the time.
I want to know because I'm unconscious most of the time when I'm working. So what is that?
So unconscious bias is, let me back up and say, I live in a big, big company. So there's 80-odd thousand people, and we have a lot of sensitivity training. And I am not the fastest person at getting these things done every year, so the deadlines come up. But I have to say, in a certain way, even though it's extra work, I appreciate them because it keeps us aware of a lot of these things. So when you think about unconscious bias, what that really, like if I can boil it down to this, if somebody says kindergarten teacher, then a lot of people think lady. And if somebody says engineer, sorry, Jackie, a lot of people would think man. And so it's that idea that we have these biases or perceptions that are preconceived and they come from entrenched and ingrained upbringings and patterns socially. Mm-hmm. So we cited a study in our report called Orchestrating impartiality.
Yeah, that's a fascinating one, where the orchestra hiring practices, the auditions were done blind. In other words, you didn't know if it was a male or a female doing the audition for the French horn or the violin or whatever.
Yeah, so this study is amazing. It's done by a lady out of Harvard named Claudia Golden, and then the economics department, and then a lady named Cecilia Rouse, and she's out of the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton. And they basically went back to the 1940s and they studied all the major orchestras in the United States. And so you can see from the 40s to about 1970, these orchestras were about 0 to 5% female. And what happened in that time was, in the 70s, was that partitions were put up so that the auditions became blind. So in other words, the people who were evaluating the potential players to join the orchestra could no longer see who was playing. And lo and behold, the participation rates for females steadily climbed up into the mid-90s. And the charts that are shown in that report get it up to about 30% roughly, but you can see the trajectory is notionally headed for 50%. Now, to be honest, I'm not sure it's quite there today, but this is very, very real. And I'm going to go down another alley here. Just let me digress for a second, but it's an important story. It's personally real as well. I was working on a Friday at 4 o'clock in Calgary, and I called and just wanted to leave a message for one of our salesmen in Toronto, so it'd be 6 p.m. Eastern time. And I was pretty sure I wasn't going to get anybody, but I called. A lady picks up the phone, and I say, "Are Fred and Barney there?" And she says, "No, they've gone home." And I was expecting that, because that's late on a Friday. And then I said, "Oh, that's too bad." And then she said, "Well, Jim and Bob are here. You want to talk to one of them?" And I said, "Oh, sure, put me through." And then I said, "Those must be the hardest two working guys at Scotia." And the other side of the phone, she came through saying, "Well, I'm still here." And I can tell you, I could not apologize fast enough. And I don't think of myself, in fact, I would say I'm not at all that kind of person, but no. There's a real world example of bias. And by the way, that lady on her sales desk, I think, is one of the hardest people I've met at Scotia. Mm-hmm. She never misses. She's amazing.
Right. So we have these unconscious biases that we're trying to work through as we evolve corporate practices and so on. So back to the report and back to what it means to companies. What you've demonstrated in this report is that you are now able to measure this stuff.
Correct. Yeah. And I think we are, and I'm probably going to use a lot of other people's assistance and words here, but I think we are in a golden age of getting more data and being able to use that in a productive way. So for me, one of the things I've said to our clients is, you can be skeptical about this, but I would strongly argue the informational utility is greater than zero.
Right. But the data, let's talk about that, because it's so important. So you've dug up all this information and you're publishing it in your reports, but it's far from universal.
Correct.
Okay. So, all these metrics like debt to cash flow, et cetera, those are standard financial metrics that every analyst knows and knows how to calculate and publish and use in terms of making recommendations about buy, sell, or holding a stock. These metrics that relate particularly to the S and the G are far from universal.
That's right. And so when we think about that, there's a few frameworks that have evolved over time that we can talk about here in a second. And then there's ratings agencies that have evolved, and there's standards. So if we think about the frameworks, one of the well-known ones that was out on the scene initially and is prominent today is the GRI, or the Global Reporting Initiative. So that started in round numbers around late 90s to 2000. And that came from Ceres, the TELUS Institute, and the UN. And that's a pretty broad set of standards that companies generally disclose according to. Now, what evolved from there in 2011 was SASB. So SASB stands for the Sustainability Accounting Standards Board. And that is notionally equivalent to FASB, or the Financial Accounting Standards Board. And the idea of SASB was to put more rigor and standardization to the metrics that are financially relevant and material in this whole realm. And I think if SASB had its druthers, it would probably just be absorbed into FASB over time. So we are getting more standardization. And then I think one of the amazing contributions that SASB has made, and it's been supported by some of the academics that you've touched on here very earnestly, is that they've mapped key issues to materiality. And so now we can, anybody can go onto their website and look at the materiality map, and you can pick into a broad industry area.
Okay, can you just pause for a second? Like materiality, can you just explain that to our listeners?
The whole challenge as an analyst, whether you're picking through financial data or governance data or environmental or social data, is to figure out what matters. So we live in a world of increasing noise where there's just an abundance of information. It's information overload. So materiality is where, as an analyzer, one is trying to figure out what really matters, like what is a driver of a company's performance or a driver of a share price, what tells the real story of an efficiency of operations or an industry. And so materiality has become a very prominent concept in the whole ESG world, because it basically alludes to the idea that if you look at this information, you can find things that help explain risk and return, and you can use that to potentially generate alpha. And for me, that is central to the whole ESG experience. And the rise of all this data is actually a huge opportunity. It's very much a, you know, we had a conference last week, and one of the presenters said it's a glass half full situation, and there's a whole bunch of running room here to exercise objective analysis to find outperformance and, again, minimize risk. Mm-hmm.
So, for example, if you're in finance, maybe GHG emissions aren't that material to you. But if you're in the oil and gas industry, it is, and so is water use, right? Because you're depending on that. It's material to your business. So it's
Correct.
Trying to say for each sector, there are key things that you need to be mm-hmm. watching. And those companies should be reporting on those things if they're in those sectors.
Correct. Right. And then the literature academically, again, from some of the individuals we've touched on, is impressive to say that if companies are trying to disclose a bunch of immaterial items, the market actually tends to see that now. And so the businesses that are focused on disclosing the right information of materiality and actually not wasting people's time with immaterial items, those tend to actually get the best reward, the best valuations in the marketplace. And the other companies who are doing the opposite, i.e. trying to bury people in information and potentially hide things, which could be called greenwashing, those businesses are starting to be seen by the market as doing as such.
I do want to mention two things that are important, I think, for our listeners to understand is a lot of investors are not necessarily looking at your reporting directly. They are buying data from aggregators who take this data, try to put it on apples to apples, and rate companies based on their ESG. And so there's companies like MSCI and Sustainalytics who are doing this work. So I think today, you know, it's very important that companies recognize that when they're doing their reporting, to work with those types of organizations. And if you don't give any information, you get an F. And if you don't give them the type of information that they see as material, you'll get a lower mark. So they're pretty, I think, important in terms of how investors view companies. Would you agree?
I think that's right. I think the market is still sorting through the process of trying to figure out how to use all this data and what to infer from it. So again, we touched on the frameworks, which would be GRI and SASB. You mentioned Sustainalytics and MSCI. Those are examples of raters, and they're more commercial operations as opposed to nonprofits. So the raters, they will look at all this information. They will build a framework analytically, or a filter, if you like. And they will push that through the factory, and then out comes a rating. Interestingly, the ratings from a lot of these agencies don't necessarily correlate with one another. And so I think a lot of investors have been wondering, okay, well, is that useful? Is this right? What's wrong? And I think there's different camps on that. Some would view that as a criticism. Others on the buy side actually accept that and say, well, it's like the buy side or any other walk in life where there's a diversity of opinions.
Right. And people have different prices.
Yeah, buy side being investors who buy.
Money managers.
Yeah. Money managers. Yeah. Yeah.
And so the diversity of opinions is actually okay. And I guess what I would say about it is that any rating, whether it's ours or another commercial operation or anyone else, it's really just a starting point. It's not an end point. And it's a starting point for judgment and to ask questions. The framework or the filter anybody builds is only as good as that. And from there, I think you get some insights and then you proceed on a path to try to understand more things.
Yeah, right. But I think this is a bit troublesome in a sense, or certainly something to think about, because let's just take it to personal level, you know, people's credit scores. You know, there's credit agencies out there opining on what your score is or what my score is. I have no idea what my score is. Maybe that's the point I'm trying to make, is if your company X in oil and gas, we'll use an oil and gas example, and you have no idea, have not bothered to understand what these rating agencies are doing, but meanwhile behind the scenes they're pumping out a score for you,
right,
then you better wake up and understand what they're doing. And as Jackie, you said, if you're not providing any information, you're automatically getting a zero.
Yeah. And you know, one of the most surprising things about your report for me was page 79 and 80. On those pages, you will see that they have ambitiously tried to rate all the companies, 250 some companies on the TSX. I think you rated almost 250.
Yep.
On their ESG score. So not just oil and gas, every sector. But when I look at the oil and gas metric or the energy metric that you have, about 40% of the names covered did not report at all. Nothing. You couldn't give them a score. For the other 60%, you gave them a score, but a lot of categories were NA, not available, but you had enough data to try to apply a score. Were you surprised that we had so many companies not reporting? And how did this compare to other sectors that you looked at on the TSX?
I mean, first off, I would say I was not surprised. I think we're still early in the game of participation rates in terms of disclosure. And in terms of other sectors, I would actually say the extractive resource sectors. So if you look at energy, you look at mining in Canada, I do think that there is a fairly sincere foot that's been put forward from those businesses. And so other parts of the economy, I think, are a little bit less tangible. And so it's a little more difficult to, I think, get your arms around what exactly we can rate. And, you know, I would hold out our bank as an example. We have a CSR report. I've read through the past couple of years. And basically, when we did our periodic table exercise, you know, it was a little bit having some fun, but we added a new element for money. And because I wanted to be able to map all the companies to the various elements that are fundamental to them, whether it's a primary extraction of it or a secondary usage of it, or even a life cycle that sees disposal of that. But when you think about financial operations, they can show very low carbon intensity or water usage or energy usage. And so my bank would be measuring how much water I drink in the cafeteria. But really, I think a lot of institutions also make their living off of the rest of the periodic table. And I'm not going to say what should necessarily be done with that, but I think it's something we all need to think about. And so when I come back to the extractive resource sector component in Canada, whether it's mining or energy, and there's all different kind of components within, I actually think that disclosure was pretty good. If we step back and we say, how do we compare to the world? So the TSX, S&P TSX 60 is disclosing at a rate of about 64%. The broader composite, so the 250 companies you mentioned, would be at about 40%. That compares to 93% for the 250 biggest companies in the world, and then 75%, which is called the N100, and that's almost 5,000 companies from 49 different markets. So again, 93 for the biggest companies, 75-ish for the broader sort of representation.
That's
of the world.
Global kind of averages.
Correct. Right. And these numbers come from KPMG, right, which generously shared that with us. And so Canada, I would argue, is a bit behind, but I do think that companies are getting in the game. Now, the other thing I'd want to say is, in fairness, there is a bias against smaller companies and that they don't have big armies of people or departments to handle this kind of information. And so it's not a barrier to entry. We do see small companies coming in and disclosing, but it does probably take time to get up to the speed where you have an organizational capability to do this.
The liquidity, in other words, the investor interest and trading of the smaller companies is less than the bigger companies. And yep. So the need for them to be reporting is greater than ever.
I really like how you bring that around. I think that disclosure is an opportunity.
It's a differentiator.
Absolutely. And I also like what you said, Jackie, in that non-disclosure can be pretty telling. And in our report, we wanted to be very careful that we did not infer it in the negative. So we showed the companies that were disclosing in quartiles. So we ranked everybody according to percentiles and sorted by quartiles. And then the companies that didn't disclose, we didn't punish them for that, but we did want to have people see who had also not disclosed. Mm-hmm. So it's a good place to start asking questions as an investor, and I think it's a great place for a company to start trying to make some inroads, because ultimately that disclosure, I think, just unquestionably opens up more doors than otherwise not disclosing.
Yeah, and I think the interesting thing is there are many companies here that you had NAs on some of the blanks, but they had reported on some and they got a score. So I think, you know, companies need to get going. They don't necessarily need to fill out the whole matrix. Maybe they can understand what's material for their business and just get something out there. Would you agree with that approach?
I think that's right. I'm personally a procrastinator in life and very guilty of that. And so sometimes, one person once said to me, you got to throw your gym bag over the fence and start climbing over. And I think that is the right thing. You just need to, if you're a company and you're wondering if you can have an impact here and do something that'll help yourself.
I think there's a couple of different categories. There's sort of the procrastinators who are not getting around to it. There are those that may not even know this is going on, some of them, and they're being rated, as I said, like a personal credit agency. You don't even know what your score is. Mm-hmm. But there's a third category of company that would say that, I don't need to do this. It's just a fad. ESG is just a fad. It's just going away. What do you say to those guys?
Great point. I mean, time will tell. And there certainly has been a real buzz in the marketplace all of a sudden for all of these metrics and themes, which has been very heartening and kind of interesting to see. I do think there is a camp of people out there who would describe it as a fad, but I don't personally subscribe to that at all. I think it truly has legs. And the reason I say that is the more you know, the more you know. The more information you have to play with as an investor or an analyzer or a company, the better off you are. From my standpoint, I think we're in an age where there's more and more data coming at us. There's more and more information. We want to understand the basic level of efficiency where businesses are and see what the trends are for improvement. And I bring it back to this idea that we do all our day job math and we try to be very diligent with that. The clients see that. We see it. The companies see it. And ultimately, when decision makers on the money management side have to make a choice about a company, I really think they lean back in their chair and they look up at the ceiling and they think, okay, what are the little things that are big points of trust that tell me a lot about the culture or the purpose of this business?
It's really fascinating. And then again, it just comes down to this common sense thing that the key material items, we talked about materiality, is trust and being responsible. I mean, you know, what a concept.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's your differentiator going forward in this chaotic world. Well, you've certainly done an excellent job in differentiating yourself and Scotiabank with this report. I really encourage people, our listeners, to click on the link and take a look at it. I think it's not a fad. I think it's here to stay. In fact, it's probably going to amplify as more of your peers get into the game. It's been a fascinating discussion. So thanks very much, Patrick Bryden from Scotiabank, for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for joining our podcast. If you liked what you heard today, please rate us on your app and tell someone else about us.
Thanks. It's been an honor.
Please check the podcast notes for the Scotiabank Disclosures website link.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.